Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, assalamu alaikum and Ramadan Mubarak. Welcome to A Time for Justice. A Time for Justice is a show on the Elevated Places Network, and I am your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. So, our guest tonight, and we have a wonderful guest, brother attorney out of Arkansas, our brother attorney, Jimmy Muhammad. He is our guest tonight, and as always with our roundtable discussions, we don't make excuses for racist conduct if we see it, because what we want to point out is that a lot of times these are distractions. They're just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. Let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. And tonight's show, we're going to be talking about the pandemic's impact on the poor in the criminal justice system. Yes, it has really, oftentimes since this is Ramadan, we wanted to think about those who aren't out necessarily, don't have their freedom. They may be incarcerated. They're behind bars. They may be facing criminal cases. This is what we call the criminal justice system. And so we wanted to talk about our people tonight. And I want to quote the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan from an article that appeared in the Final Call about trauma and women in prison. And in response to, I think, there were marches, there were survivors, there were women who are incarcerated, they have families. And our brother, student minister, Lionel Muhammad, he quoted the minister, and he said that the minister said to adopted, he said, he asked the minister why he told marchgoers to adopt an inmate. And according to Lionel Muhammad, the minister responded, that's a whole nother world that we're disconnected from. So if everybody adopts an inmate and we do it in a unified manner, then we're connected to that world and we change the reality of this world, he quoted the minister. So in that spirit of Ramadan, looking out for those of us who have needs, I wanted to introduce this particular topic. And our brother Jimmy Morris is the managing partner at Morris Law Firm. He practices in the areas of criminal defense, civil rights, civil litigation, and personal injury. Brother Jimmy Morris, he is admitted to the bar in Arkansas, both in the state and federal court. He is also admitted to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Mr. Morris is a native of Arkansas. He attended the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff and the University of Arkansas, I believe, at Little Rock, where he earned an associate degree in law enforcement and a bachelor's in political science and criminal justice. He also attended the University of Arkansas School of Law in Fayetteville, Arkansas, where he earned a Juris Doctorate. Jimmy Morris, attorney Jimmy Morris, is a member of Omega Psi Phi fraternity, the Harold Flowers Law Society, Phi Delta Phi legal fraternity, the NAACP, and the ACLU. And he is the proud parent of two children, Jimmy Morris III and Micaiah Morris. And so I want to go ahead and open up Brother Jimmy's mic. Let's see. Oh. Brother Jimmy.
Yes, ma'am. I'm here. That's such a wonderful introduction.
Oh, praises be to Allah. You're such a wonderful attorney. And thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you taking your time, sir.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Yes, sir. So I know you've been working hard as always.
Well, I can tell you this. We had a per curiam by the Arkansas Supreme Court that delayed trials for about 14 months. And
okay.
After 14 months, it seemed like every judge in every county wanted to try cases. And so those lawyers that had been playing around and taking people's money and not ready to live up to what they had been hired to do ran for the hills. And so what that has left is a vacuum. So I've tried 16 jury trials in the last 10 months, have four set for April. So I've been working like a I don't even have a good analogy, but it's just a lot of work, man. It's hard out here.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for your hard work, because we're going to get right back to that topic. I want to go ahead and open up and talk about the pandemic's impact on the poor and the criminal justice system. And I just wanted to start out with a Final Call article from May 20, 2021, that talked about women and the trauma in the highest form that women are suffering, a culture of abuse in prison. And they talked about how they had rallies. So, you know, again, this is during this whole pandemic, January 2nd and January 16th, 2022. I believe the women were making allegations and complaints that there were rapes, beatings, deaths going on in the prison. Because as the author, and this was an article written by our sister Anissa, she brought out the fact that there's been a 700% increase in incarcerated women from 1980 to 2019. Of women is twice as high, has become twice as high. During COVID, I think in this prison there were 276 active cases, and over 1,000 women had tested positive. And again, according to this article, they talk about the violations in the prison, which are a violation of the constitutional rights of the inmates. It's a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And I don't want to just say inmates. I want to say women, people, humans. And they were talking about how the violations have to do with sexual abuse. So at more than 60%, and I just want to close this out, but always remember, listeners, that more than 60% of women in state prisons have children under the age of 18. And 5 million children nationwide have a parent in prison. And this article just kind of ends with making the point that that's a very traumatic situation. And so next, I wanted to really go ahead and dive into the conversation that Brother Jimmy is really going to illuminate and talk to us about. Because as he said, in the state of Arkansas, there is it looks like a real crisis going on with the cases where indigent people are being confronted with lawyers who are juggling up to four times the number of cases that they handled before the pandemic. Like you said, Brother Jimmy, trials are had been suspended and other things, but this led to a real backlog. So talk to us about that, because you're there in those trenches. So,
What has happened in Arkansas is, for lack of a better word, speedy trial has been suspended. And so essentially in Arkansas, there's a law that says if a person is in custody or in jail or prison, then they have to be tried within 9 months. The person is not in custody, they have to be tried within 12 months. Well, there was a 14-month per curiam where no jury trials could take place. Curiam was lifted. It was lifted May 11, 2021. Now you have all these cases backlogged, and then there's a hierarchy of cases. So murder, capital murder, cases involving children, cases involving sexual assault, all go to the front of the line. So if a person is in jail or prison, and the reason they can be in prison and they haven't been tried yet is they may have been revocated on another case that they had prior to that. Then they're sitting and waiting on a case that essentially is not a high priority case. So a drug case, a domestic battery case, something of that nature will be pushed to the back of the line. So I know one judge here, and it got so bad, he had 4,800 active cases. And, I mean, for him to get rid of 4,800 active cases, he would have to deal with 4,000 cases a month and have them disposed of. Well, if 1,200 of them want a trial, then it's just a log jam. And that log jam is causing defendants to just sit and wait. And so we're finally getting around to trying cases that are 19 and 20 cases that would have been in queue during the per curiam. It has gotten so bad here that in the major counties in Arkansas, the public defenders have stood up and told judges they can't take any more cases because they're way past the level of competency with the number of cases. In other words, they're saying that the amount of cases they have, in order to be competent, they can't take any more cases. However, the state files cases every day. So the head of the Public Defender Commission, we have a commission that deals with public defenders as a whole and deals with public defenders, the overseeing of the whole department, or what we would call indigency representation, now assigns private attorneys cases if there's a conflict, and also can assign private attorneys cases if there's a backlog. Well, most private attorneys are backlogged. So the head of the Public Defender Commission just went to the Arkansas legislature and got them to dedicate extra money to hiring new lawyers. And then they found out that there are not enough lawyers. So we now have people who are sitting and waiting cases that do not have a attorney assigned to them, which is clear violation of the U.S. Constitution. A person who is indigent should have an attorney assigned to them. That means nothing can go on in their case. They can't even plead not guilty without having an attorney assigned. The backlog is so bad that also the prosecutors were given extra money to hire extra people, and there are not enough lawyers. So we're just basically chipping away at it. I can tell you what makes my private clients feel like. My private clients feel that things should be happening a lot faster. I have clients who, you know, want their discovery, and the state just can't get it out fast enough. people who want their case to go to trial and get this behind them because they're trying to go to medical school, law school, nursing school, that can't even get a court date. And so for a person who doesn't have a voice, for a person who maybe have some mental deficiencies or undiagnosed mental illness, or for individuals who cannot afford legal services, they're just sitting in limbo, and it is horrible.
Yes, sir. Yeah, let me I was reading some articles on this. So according to one article, they talked about the racial disparity in the Arkansas criminal justice system, where 15% black, they say, is the population, but black people make up 45% of those in jail. In terms of this backlog that you're saying, where these lawyers have cases and a lot of cases, they're saying that there's one opinion that said that these lawyers shouldn't have any more than 150 cases per year, but some of them, according to an article I read, and I think it was the Northwest Arkansas Democrat, they said that some of them were handling 300 felonies, maybe even 526 felonies. I think that's one lawyer said. And one of the problems, mm-hmm. Brother Jimmy, they quoted, was that there were 30 people, defendants, who had cases. I think one person may have had up to about 30 cases of a defendant who could be facing like 10 to 40 years or life in prison. And so as you're saying, there a lawyer needs to be able to render effective assistance to counsel. And with these type of numbers, you know, the public defender's office said they can't do it. They're throwing their own, you know, selves on the sword even before, saying we can't handle all these cases and do any kind of job. Is that some of what you're hearing as well?
No, I watched it happen in Pulaski County, Saline County, and Jefferson County. The public defenders said they cannot take any more cases. They refused to take assignments from judges. And so that caused the Public Defender Commission to have to try to hire other lawyers. The problem is private attorneys are overwhelmed as well. I mean, I've had cases set on the same day in different jurisdictions, and literally have to explain to judges in the same judicial district, same area, that I'm set for another murder trial the same day. And I can tell you, 3 weeks ago, I had a murder case that started on a Tuesday. It started on Tuesday. I hung the jury on Wednesday. On Thursday, I had to voir dire another jury for a failure to appear case let me see how far away it was. I was on one side of the state, which it was 2 hours from Little Rock. Little Rock is the center. And then I had to go 2 hours away to try the next case. Voir dire that jury. And luckily, the prosecutor in my case that was supposed to start on Friday offered me a sweetheart deal because he was exhausted. But literally, I was going to have three jury trials in the same week, even though each judge knew about the conflict and knew what I tried the day before. And because of their logjam and their docket, they did not care.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't care.
Yeah.
So,
that's horrible.
So literally, try a case, a murder case, in which I'm supposed to concentrate everything on it. Then while I'm waiting on the jury to come back, not knowing if I'm going to have to do sentencing, I'm supposed to be preparing for another case. And while I'm in the middle of that case, then I'm supposed to prepare for another case and try it the next day. And that's the kind of position they're putting private attorneys in. And here's the funny part about it. Those judges were apologetic because it seemed like with them having, you know, as many active cases in that county, I seem to be the only lawyer ready to try cases. And so I can tell you, I've tried 16 jury trials in the last 10 months. One of the courts in which I got a not guilty in a murder case told me that they had only tried three cases since the per curiam was lifted, but I had tried 12 by then. So the reality of it is, if I am anything common to what most private attorneys are experiencing, we are just trying back-to-back trials, and there's no way. I mean, I am lucky that I'm able to recover well, and I have an assistant that's very helpful. But there's really no way that you can recover and try these cases back-to-back, not to mention the mental strain and emotional and psychological strain that goes on from going from one murder case to one capital murder case to a rape case to, I mean, there's no time to decompress to get that case out of your head before you go into another, or even the emotional toll of your political, religious, or moral philosophy versus the people you represent. You have no time to get it out of your system. You have to turn around and get to saving someone else. And so I can tell you right now, I probably have 100 cases that are felony cases in my office now. 10 are capital murders, one to get the death penalty. Only 5 of those have waived the death penalty. So 5, I have to put in the work for a capital murder defense. It is overwhelming. It is tiring. And I seem to think that I'm one of the strong ones. So you can almost imagine
what a
not-so-qualified lawyer would be. We've had law students here because of the pressure and the strain that they see with the field and practice they're about to come into, commit suicide. I've seen at least 2 in the local law school.
Oh, no. Goodness.
Not even in the practice yet.
Wow, that is horrible. And we want the listeners to know that, you know, unfortunately, one of the dangers of what he's describing, like he says, he's one of the good ones, but there is a study that will tell you that there is a connection between wrongful convictions and what can be described as sometimes ineffective defense lawyering. And I think that's one of the big issues that we want to talk about with our clients and with these defendants, because as they're sitting in these overcrowded prisons, they're dealing with lawyers who are having to deal with much more volume, and it is very unfortunate in terms of potentially the outcomes of some of these cases. Like Brother Jimmy's saying, he works nonstop and has ethics to make sure he's doing the best that he can. You know, but you know what, Brother Jimmy, I thought it was very interesting because in some articles I was reading, they were talking about how the corrections department or the state, they want to spend $60 to $100 million for 498 new prison beds. And they actually, I read another article I thought was so amazing, how they, in May of 21, there was a multi-year contract awarded to, I think it's UA Little Rock, for $453,000 to study prisoners. You know, but that, you know, but here we are looking at this lack of, you know, being able to really get these cases done. You know, they, I guess the money, the budgets, and all of that are very interesting. So I just want to make sure everybody knows that you're listening to A Time for Justice, and we have Brother Attorney Jimmy Morris, Jr. out of Little Rock, Arkansas, and actually the whole state of Arkansas. And we're talking today about how there is just a real pandemic, or one of the effects of the pandemic in Arkansas is that their cases are stalled. Lawyers, they don't even have enough lawyers to handle the cases. And, you know, our people are sitting oftentimes in these jails and in these prisons suffering. And like I say, I do have to just bring out this issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. because that's a really big issue, even here in the state of Central. This, Brother Jimmy, in 2014, I got a case, I got an article that talked about how private attorneys were accused of cronyism, and they were handling up to like between 500 to 2,500 cases in 2014. And I think they were saying it was reasonable to do 230 cases in a given year, but some of these lawyers were handling from 500 to 2,500. That's, of course, the top tier. But, you know, it was a quote from a University of McKinney School of Law professor. He said in this article, he said it's a joke. You know, it tells me immediately that you're not really investigating the cases. They can't, they're not doing what they need to do. Because, you know, it's just really hard. It's impossible in some ways. So, you know, again, looking at this crisis where our people, you know, are suffering during the pandemic, there's another article I just wanted to bring out that happened in Bastrop, Texas last week. An article came out about the children who are in the Department of Family and Protective Services custody, and how the article reads that the federal judge, U.S. District Judge Janice Jack, has ordered a criminal investigation into allegations of sex trafficking at a DFPS contracted facility in Bastrop, Texas, after abuse claims in January. And I'm just kind of bringing this up to say that, you know, these are the people who live, unfortunately, in custodial care. And they said nearly 300 children in this article spent at least one night in unlicensed facilities. And some of these children actually sleep in CPS offices and motel rooms in 2021. So, you know, again, our topic is pandemic's impact on poor in the criminal justice system. Because Brother Jimmy, what makes this term, when we say indigent defense, indigent clients, who are we talking about? What are we really talking about?
Well, it's always funny because when people come into my office as a private attorney and they start saying, well, my brother, my sister, my baby doesn't even have a lawyer. And I say, well, he can't go forward or she can't go forward without having an attorney. Well, yeah, they got a public defender. And I always start laughing because 40% of my cases are public defender commission cases, and in which essentially I'm a public defender. And so I always say the difference between a private attorney and a public defender oftentimes is not the quality of representation, but it is the person who's paying us at the end of the case or beginning of the case. A public defender is only one who is paid by the state, and that person can be paid for one case. They can have a contract where they do all the cases of a particular type, or they can be paid to do all of the particular cases in a particular jurisdiction. Give you an example. A person can be on the Public Defender Commission in Arkansas, and all they do is capital murder cases. So they only come into play when there's a capital murder case and there's a conflict with the public defender's office. Or the person can be assigned to a particular district court, and they're paid a contract, $30,000 a year, to deal with all the misdemeanors in this particular jurisdiction. Or they can be a person who is a full-time public defender who works in a particular court and represents people from that standpoint. Now, the reality of it is there was a case in 1963, I really can't remember the name, but I used to have it on the tip of my tongue, that says that a person is entitled to competent counsel even if they can't afford that counsel. And so person should not be allowed to represent or have to represent themselves if they cannot afford an attorney. And so attorneys are assigned to them, or the public defender is what came out of this these cases. And so a person has to have an attorney to go forward according to constitutional law on any case in which they can receive more than 60 days in jail. So any case that they can receive more than 60 days in jail, they have the right to an attorney. So if you've been in court and you've had to sign a form that says you waive the right to counsel and then you plead guilty, that's because the likelihood of the likelihood of you getting more than 60 days was low, but the penalty range was over 60 days. The case name that made it constitutional law is the case called Gideon versus Wainwright.
Gideon
versus Wainwright.
Right.
And what happened in this case that prompted this going to the Supreme Court is a unlearned person who could not afford an attorney. I guess having an attorney prior to this was a luxury and not a right. He could not afford an attorney, so he tried a case, and he was convicted because he didn't know any procedural law or any of that. And basically the Supreme Court says any person who cannot afford an attorney would have the right to an attorney. And so that's the case that produced what we call public defenders today, a branch of attorneys that are paid by the state to represent people who are indigent. And public defenders are like anybody else. There are some terrible ones, and there are some great ones. There are some that if I go to a courtroom, the first person I go talk to is the public defender because they know that courtroom in and out. The reality of it is we are at a point where we are violating Gideon versus Wainwright because for your attorney to be competent, they have to have enough time and enough resources to work on your case. So just because are a qualified, competent lawyer that has passed the bar does not mean that anything else that comes into play that makes them not competent would not change that analysis. Now, here's the problem. If your trial lawyer misses an objection to something that is material to changing the outcome of the case, he or she has waived it for you, which means the appellate lawyer cannot look at the record and say, oh, I would have objected here, and the person missed it, so therefore this case should come back. If you miss it, it's gone. Sometimes if you don't say it fast enough and the next question comes, it's gone. And so a person may be stuck with the fact their lawyer did not file this motion, did not ask for this particular remedy, or didn't object to that particular piece of evidence coming in. And so the competency is not if the person is qualified and competent, but if the person is competent based on their caseload, based on their ability to work on the case, based on their competency level with the particular type of case, and the list goes on. So a first-year lawyer out of school may not be qualified to work on a capital murder case because they don't have enough experience, they don't have enough expertise in that particular area. So competency goes past the point of being qualified, but you have to be able to do the job under a pressure situation. Now, I will tell you that a jury trial is like a war in the trenches. You have to be able to shoot while people are shooting at you, which means that sometimes you got to be able to listen to your client, listen to the evidence, look at the file, highlight a portion of it, and still object to a poor question at the same time. It is mind-numbing. And a two-day trial is different than a five-day trial. This is different than a 10-day trial. And then after the case, somebody comes behind you and looks at the record and they Monday morning quarterback of what they would have done in the moment. And the reality of it is competency is a lot more than just being qualified.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much for that. And for those of you all who are listening, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. Because I heard you saying some really awesome things, Brother Jimmy. One of the things I heard you talk about objections made in the trial. And also there's a lot of work that has to be done even before a trial is even you get to the trial. And I think that's some place that our listeners or anyone who's looking at lawyers or has a personal issue, they should really look at what is their lawyer doing in terms of what investigation, trial prep, right? That's important. And then when you talked about the objections, because I'm just kind of throwing some of these stats out here, you know, one of the things so important about these objections is that, like you say, innocent people can be convicted of cases that they're not even guilty of because evidence is improperly in a case or, you know, failure to get in certain evidence. And so I just wanted to throw out there that they say 70% of those who have been exonerated for being wrongfully convicted are black. You know, there's an article that said that a black man is 3.5 times more likely to be innocent and convicted of some type of sexual assault case than a white person who was convicted of that same type of case. You know, and innocent people, you know, and again, this is like big news these days. You see all this wrongfully convicted. People have been in jail for years for things that they didn't do. And they're saying that the average is that people are spending 14 years per person spent in jail, and that their average age that they went in was like 26 and they came out at 43. So, you know, just some really sobering facts as to why what Attorney Morris is saying is so important. So, again, if there are any questions or comments, I see we do have one person who wants to, I'm going to go ahead and open up her mic. Sister Marguerite, assalamu alaikum.
Yes, ma'am. Well, alaikum salam, and well, alaikum salam, brother. Really I'm enjoying your this discussion. A question. Yes, it is much needed education. Comment and a question. My comment or both questions. When you talk about the backlog and all of this, could you talk about also? This issue, I think it was brought out of New York, how people were being put in jail for not paying fines. And from what I heard, another lawyer said this is unconstitutional, that they're holding people for these fines. And on the other end, could you also discuss this newly passed lynching bill, you know, that has been on, that black people have been fighting to get passed for 1,000 years, and now it's passed, but isn't it too little, too late, and haven't they changed the game and how they lynch us, how it's perceived?
Well,
brother,
and this point, Pamela will tell you that I sometimes have varying opinions on things, and I look at things from a different perspective. I never look at a law that protects black people from white folk as being too little, too late. Obviously, there could be more, but after 100 years, I'm glad that at least some of the great, 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 great grandchildren of these individuals thought there was enough to sign it into law or to vote against it. So I'm not going to be, I don't know how to say it. I'm not going to say too little too late, because anytime you can protect a black person from something, I'm with it. I remember I used to tell people I wasn't a civil rights lawyer. I was in a civil rights law firm for a long time, and one of my criminal defense buddies came to me and said, what civil right is more important than protecting one's life, liberty, or property. And I said, oh, well, I guess I am a civil rights lawyer. I think that any law that's set up to protect us or any law that is set up to be helpful to exonerate us or helpful to get us adequate representation in a system that we find ourselves in is better than nothing. If you only had bread to eat, I mean, great that you want something better, but bread is at least good enough to sustain you till you can get to something better. The second thing is, I think you're talking about in New York, a debtor's prison, where poor people are given exorbitant fines and if they cannot pay them because of their resources, then they're put in jail until either they pay them or they sit their time out. I do believe that a debtor's prison is unconstitutional. And what happens in a lot of these cases is the fines start out small and de minimis. And I say de minimis, you know, $500 fine doesn't sound bad to me as a lawyer, but to a person who is in New York that may make $15 an hour, it is probably horribly, horribly high because, number one, the cost of living, cost of doing everything is tremendous there. Who cannot pay their fine, or their fine becomes less of a priority than feeding their children, than, you know, paying their bills or sustaining their life, and then they get arrested for it. Once they get arrested, they are convicted of, at least in Arkansas how it would work, they'd be convicted of failure to pay fines, which is another crime itself. It's kind of like failure to appear. Failure to appear is a crime in and of itself. Even though it ought not to be, person does not come to court, they ought not get another felony for not coming to court. Laws have found their way on the books that say failure to pay fines, failure to pay costs, failure to pay probation fees are now a crime in and of themselves, and so they convict you again, give you another $500 fine plus court costs. And basically, you get to a point to where penalties, interest, time pays, which you add, in Arkansas they add $10 per month, you can never really get your way out of that. And no matter what they do, no matter how long they lock you up, you still won't be able to pay it because your ability to generate resources is limited.
That's right,
brother.
That's right,
brother.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Pamela.
Yes, ma'am.
And to what motivated me to ask about that lynching bill was as I listened to the attorney, Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the critical race theory is, you know, hot in the educational field, is that even though you may have a lynching bill passed, it lays within the purview of the Supreme Court to even determine what lynching is or ain't. So you can pass all the laws you want. Come to the Supreme Court, there's one to say what it is and what it ain't. And I was really surprised, shocked to find out from Ms. Crenshaw that the Dred Scott decision is alive and well in the judicial system and has been recently used in court because it has not been struck down in any way, shape, and form.
Yes, ma'am. Well, yes, ma'am. Well, thank you for your comments, Sister Marguerite, and Ramadan Mubarak to you. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for your comments. This is why separation is always on the table as well at a time for justice. So, yes, ma'am. We have another caller. Let me go ahead and take this caller, Brother Tola Muhammad. Let's see, Brother Tola. Yes, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Yes, ma'am. Wa alaikum salam. Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Kareem, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I just want to make a comment on what brother was saying about the judicial system out of California. I did 25 years in state prison out here in California. And we're talking about the under the COVID in California, they have, once you're arrested for a felony or basically any arrest, you have 72 hours to get to your arraignment, and you have 120 days in order for you to get to trial. And through this pandemic, they have superseded that in holding people absorbent amounts of time in California state prison. We have more prisons in California than anywhere in the United States. And through private prisoning, and they're building these prisons. And blacks, like you're saying about dealing with public defenders and attorneys that don't have the really tenaciousness to follow, and they have so many, their caseload is so big, and especially young blacks don't understand what the court system is about, and they get bamboozled into 25 to life, 15 years to life, and they could have beat the case in 120 days, but they are under the impression an attorney tell them to waive time because they have to look at the case, and they have to look at that, and they give the prosecution and the state enough time to build evidence on most of these kids.
Beautiful. That is so correct. Thank you so much. Brother Jimmy, did you have any comments that you wanted to make regarding that? Because I know you. Go ahead. Thank you, Brother Tony.
I can tell you that. I mean, it's I know it's bad all over the U.S. I can tell you it's horrible where I am, and I can only imagine what it is in other places. I can give you an example of there's a lawyer I've been in practice 15 years. There's a lawyer in 15 years, we've never heard of him trying a case. But he goes to the jail, and what he does is he finds out who was newly arrested. He goes and sits down with them. He's very empathetic. He gets them to give them $500 to start working on the case, and he will get off the case or run to the hills or force somebody into a plea if they decide or opt to go to trial. And there are a lot of lawyers who take felony cases every day, and you ask them how many jury trials they've had. Some of them say, I've been in practice 3 years and I've never had a jury trial. I've been a public defender for 2 years and never had a jury trial. And you start to ask, how is that possible? And the only way it seems to be possible is if every they've had ended up in an amazing plea, or they're pushing people into pleas that they ought not take. So I know that, in fact, happens. One of the things about Arkansas law that we pushed, a lot of the lawyers pushed years ago, is that you have 90 days after you plea to determine if your attorney is ineffective. So you can file in Arkansas ineffective assistance of counsel within 90 days of you pleading guilty, which has been helpful, because if you can show the things that our brother was just discussing to a neutral and detached magistrate, you may get a new trial and may get a new lawyer. And so that's the one of the only remedies I've seen recently that has been helpful.
Yes, sir. And you know what, Brother Ayatollah, excuse me if I mispronounced your name earlier. Sister Tiffany Muhammad also wanted me to talk with you about some of the work that you do out in California with young men, I guess, with or some of the work that you maybe do to help people who are in at risk or in the criminal justice system.
Yes, ma'am. Well, we are myself and a couple of ex-convicts, about 220 of us nationwide, called Credible Messengers. And we try to give young black men an education on the things that they need to do to avoid the situations that put themselves in this type of position. And with the the kids that are incarcerated, we try to give them some information that's helpful to them, like Brother was saying about dealing with lawyers that are not really for your benefit at the things that you're doing. So we have a ongoing program constantly. I'm from Compton, California, and we try to deal with gang members. You know, you can't tell somebody what not to do, but you can kind of recreate what they need to do through the paths and through our trails. And by the grace of Allah, and Minister Louis Farrakhan has given us a direct vision on how to deal with our people.
Beautiful. Yes, sir. Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yes, sir. Yes. Well, thank you for your comment, Brother Ayatollah. Thank you for calling in to A Time for Justice.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Yes, and Brother Jimmy, one of the things he brought up, I think you were talking about speedy trial. And I think he was also bring that up when he was saying how long you can hold the people or hold a person. Is that do you have any description that you can give to us as to what a speedy trial means?
Well, 72 hours is not for arraignment. They have 72 hours would be for. Okay, well let me say it this way. There are two ways a state can charge an individual. There's only one way that they can be charged unless they waive it. And so the first way would be by indictment. That's a grand jury, 28 to 40 people get in the room and determine if there's enough for this case to go forward. Once that happens, the person is indicted. All they need to indict somebody is probable cause. The second way that a person is charged is by a bill of information. Essentially, a prosecutor sits down, writes out the charge, shows it to a judge with the probable cause hearing and says there's enough to go forward. Both of those ways, a person can be charged with merely probable cause. So the 72-hour window is a first appearance, and in most cases, it's a probable cause hearing to determine if there's enough to go forward or enough to hold the person and to address bond. Once that happens, each state is different, and the federal government has a vague statute on speedy trial, but I can tell you this. Most of the time when a person is federally indicted and you go to federal court, they're just about ready to try that case unless it's a large and complicated case when they hand you the file. So that's why in federal court, a person can be in trial in the next 6 weeks on a case they just went to plea and arraignment on. In state court, it's a little bit more labored. So, for example, Arkansas speedy trial runs if a person's in custody after 9 months and they haven't been to trial, 9 months from the date of arrest or the service of a warrant. If the person is out of custody, they have 1 year from the date of arrest or service of a warrant, whichever one comes first, to try the person. So speedy trial runs at different times in different states. And federal system, depending on what statute is or case law is. Generally, a state can provide more protection than the Constitution, but never less. So the federal speedy trial may be 6 weeks. The state can say, well, speedy trial is up to 1 year, but it can never provide less than what the federal government or constitutional law gives. So whatever the constitutional law is or the Supreme Court says, that's what would be superior to what a state court does. Now, there are laws in which the state has the absolute purview to deal with a case, i.e., if a person is murdered inside of a state, it is a state crime. It is generally not a federal crime, unless the person was murdered in some type of federal conspiracy during something or they were some type of federal official. In cases that the state has the absolute jurisdiction to deal with it, there's no federal crime that overlaps it. The state has to provide the bare minimum constitutional restrictions but can provide more, but never less, if that makes sense.
Yes, sir. No, it makes perfect sense. Thank you. You know, I guess talk to me about, I know a friend of mine, Attorney Gerald Christmas, we were talking last week, and he described the scenario where the state, it was time for trial. Case got called for trial. He, you know, appeared and announced ready, whereas the state was really wanting a continuance, and if he had not announced ready, then, you know, the case ended up getting dismissed because they weren't ready. And that was some advice he gave last time about making sure that you do announce ready, even if you're a defendant, an indigent, you know, or if you're representing yourself maybe at a traffic ticket, you know, just go ahead and announce ready. But my question to you was, with all these people who are being stalled in these state courts because of this unreadiness to go to trial, because they're so overloaded, are there some violations of their rights to really move forward? Are people being held that shouldn't be being held?
Well, what I tell people the time is this. In most cases, the defendant has to waive the speedy trial. And so if the lawyer is not prepared, but the defendant is not waiving their right to a speedy trial, then the lawyer has to go forward. Now, what is also happening is clog of cases means there's a backlog of crime lab, ballistics, all the people that would be necessary to the state case. So judges are now giving the state a little bit of leeway because the state cannot put on their case without having a crime lab, without having a medical examiner, without having the evidence back. And, of course, that's at a log jam as well. My last murder case, I don't think I asked the proper question in my investigation, but the question came out during trial on why the state police submitted 25 pieces of evidence and we only got reports back on 3 of them. And the reality of it was the crime lab says they only test 3 pieces of the evidence. Told by the police department to test more, they don't test it. So there was evidence in these particular kits that may have absolved my client from being charged or convicted. He wasn't convicted because I hung the jury. But because they did not even test it, that evidence never came about. And so there are delays that can happen on the state side that judges and the Supreme Courts of the state are giving state prosecutors some leeway because they can't get the information back from their agencies that sort and go through the evidence.
Tell me, talk to me about exculpatory evidence, because I think, what is exculpatory evidence? A prosecutor has, is supposed to turn over evidence that could be helpful to a client, but sometimes I guess they don't. Does that make sense?
Okay. It does. There was a case, a Supreme Court case called Brady versus Maryland. And in this case, it states that any evidence that could inculpate or exculpate a defendant has to be turned over to the defense attorney. And the reason why evidence that could inculpate the defendant has to be turned over is because that may make the defendant make a decision in his case that could end up in a plea. If the evidence is overwhelming on a case, the defendant may decide differently. The basis of Brady versus Maryland was information that could show that the criminal defendant may be innocent, or may not, innocent is the wrong word, not guilty.
Right.
Now, what was happening before Brady versus Maryland is the prosecutors would turn over the evidence that inculpated the criminal defendant, but wouldn't turn over the evidence that showed that it could have been another person, it could
right.
have been someone else, it could have not been them. And oftentimes, if it's buried by the police or buried by the prosecution, there's no way that a defense attorney or an investigator can find it. So it's not like if they don't turn it over, find it at another source, it would just be buried and disappear. And it led to wrongful convictions. So now the law says
right.
that any evidence that could inculpate, you know, or find them guilty or show their guilt or anything that could show their not guiltiness or innocence has to be turned over. And so a competent defense attorney can utilize that to help his client. And so that
yes.
information is necessary, but there's a standard for it. Give you an example. If a police officer pulls a person over and has a body cam and has a dash cam, but through the normal course of action, that body cam is overridden or the dash cam disappears. Prosecutor never knew about it, so he never turned it over. That's not a Brady violation. It has to be an intentional not turning over or so reckless not turning over that it will cause the defendant not to have a fair trial. It can't be negligent or slight, which means that some prosecutors play into that. Police officer never turned it over to me. I never turned it over to you. Never knew about it. That's not a violation. Now, if there is information that's out there, the prosecutor figures it out during trial, the remedy could be that the person is found not guilty, that the person is mistried and they got to try it again, or it could be an outright dismissal depending on the how culpable the prosecution is in it.
So as you were saying, you were using the words inculpate. So it's kind of like they'll give you the evidence oftentimes that make you look guilty. they turn that over. But sometimes the evidence that may be in your favor or raise the issue that you may be innocent, that's what's really important, that a Brady motion, that your lawyer files something that will make sure they give you all the evidence. It was very interesting that you brought up police cameras and all of that, because I know they have different angles. You can see one police camera and you don't see a particular incident occurring, but you see it from a different angle and you see everything. Go ahead, Brother Jimmy. I'm sorry.
But Brady says you have to give them all the information that inculpates them. Sometimes prosecutors won't give you evidence that inculpates the person because they're trying to ambush them at trial. So Brady says that, no, you have to give them the stuff that will also find them guilty. I mean, you cannot stack the deck so that you can get a higher sentence. And so it cuts both ways. Yes, they have to give you the information that will exculpate them, but they also have to give them the stuff that will find them guilty so that they can make a good decision. And withholding either part of that can be a Brady violation. So it cuts both ways.
Yes, sir. Now, I know in Texas, if they don't turn over evidence to you that is could have you, they're going to use in trial against you, then they can't, if they don't turn it over, then they can't use it. That creates a barrier to being able to use the evidence. So that's very important. Go ahead.
The same way here as well. However, it could be the basis to dismiss the case if it was intentional, because that may have made the defendant make a decision towards pleading. In other words, a lot of times people don't understand that the reason attorneys will tell an individual to take a plea is because, one, their exposure may be higher than a plea, but two, depending on the jury, you may get what you call the trial tax. So they offer you 5 years on a case in which you can get 25. If you go to trial and lose and the jury does not look like you, you has no commonality with you or no any empathy for you, then you may end up getting 20 years. Well, the evidence that was withheld that may or may not be used could have been used by the defense attorney to convince his client that the case was harder than the defendant may think it is. And that may produce a plea in which a plea beforehand was not there. I'll give you a case that I had when I was a young lawyer, and there was a mother who came in, and she was a mama bear. She did not think her kid had done anything wrong. And her child had been involved with going into someone's house and stealing a TV. It was a burglary. And the question I asked the kid in front of the mom was, how is your fingerprints in a house that you don't know the owner and you've never been there before? And he said, I don't know. And the mom started talking about police planning and all that. And so eventually I got fired. Another one of my buddies was hired on the case. And by some form or fashion, I represented the co-defendant in this case in another case. So he calls me and says, hey, Jimmy, I need to go talk to your client about this case that they fired you on. You represented a co-defendant. You didn't represent him in the same case, but you represent him in another case. So I just wanted to get your permission to go talk to him. I said, yeah, you know, do what you got to do. So he went and talked to the guy, and the guy said, yeah, we both broke in the house. We stole the stuff. We went to the pawn shop or went to the street and sold the stuff, and we split the proceeds. Well, he reported that back to the mom, and where the child wouldn't take a probation offer when I was telling him, turned around, took the same probation offer, because now there's more evidence showing that he was involved and more evidence that would have convicted him. So just the level of evidence that was shown to the child and the mom changed their position on pleading. And so sometimes that information that may be Tory is helpful in showing a person they don't need to roll the dice, if that makes sense.
Sir. No, that definitely makes sense. You're right. Because, you know, as we are coming down at the end of the show, we still have a little time left. But I really am concerned with these backlogs of cases where you have lawyers handling, you know, much more cases than what they were used to. 300 felonies, 500 felonies, where the standard had been 150 per year. And even before the pandemic, according to some articles I read, Arkansas was having problems. Like I say, Texas was definitely stacking the deck and handling more cases when you talk about indigent people. Because when we talk about indigent people, we're talking about what's the standard? Is it below what in terms of being considered indigent and not being able to hire an attorney? A lot of times people, they don't know their rights. Like you say, they may find themselves in courts where people don't look like them. So there's a real ability to take advantage of the situation, which is, like you said, sometimes these lawyers who result in these pleas, $500, you're giving everybody a plea. So I guess my question really is, are we looking at something that can end up being a tsunami, maybe wrongful convictions or ineffective assistance of counsel with a lot of our people who have found themselves in the criminal justice system during this time especially? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll say this. I can tell you this. I'm overwhelmed. and everybody around me is overwhelmed. And so even if you're competent on one day, the next case you may not be as competent on. I think what's going to have to happen is, and in Arkansas, I think it's already being done. I think that a federal lawsuit is going to have to be filed that says that some of these people are being held past speedy trial and that they ought to be, their cases ought to be dismissed for lack of speedy trial. There's going to have to be something that changes to alleviate the pressure. And I can see now that the prosecutor's offices are starting to take low-priority cases and plead them out with very good deals. I had an aggravated robbery that I've never had in Arkansas happen. An aggravated robbery ended up in probation. So I think that there's going to be several remedies that start to happen. Prosecutor's offices are going to get rid of low-priority cases, cases in which witnesses aren't available. They're going to start dismissing them. But I still think it's going to be overwhelming, and I still think there's going to have to be something to alleviate the pressure. And maybe it's a federal lawsuit. Maybe it's something that is pushed up to the Circuit Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court that says that some of these individuals during this backlog, because they waited so long, have to be let out on speedy trial or any other procedural grounds. But there's going to have to be something that alleviates the pressure. It's not going to go away on its own.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? There's an article that talks about the ACLU, I think, in the state of Maine, has actually filed a lawsuit regarding their indigent defense system because they say the people are not getting any type of representation. I had the article over here, but I think it's not so much the state of Maine. It's actually officials in Maine that run the indigent defense system. And initially I did, you know, I looked at Maine and they say that's only, what, about 2% black people in Maine. But here we are again. You've got over 7% of the people incarcerated in that state are black. But yeah, there's an article where the ACLU filed a lawsuit, I think a couple of weeks ago, regarding the indigent defense system in that state. So I think it's really just a matter of time, like you say, these big federal lawsuits. Because, there's a article, wrongfully convicted man sues Kansas County for $93 million. So we have a March 19th article, Kansas man spent 23 years in prison for a double murder he didn't commit. And now he's suing the county where he was convicted and a former police officer for $93 million. This man spent 23 years in prison. And then, you know, there was an article in the Final Call. And I think it's very interesting because this young man by the name of Ali, Brother Ali, he actually is incarcerated. And, the allegation is that he did not commit this crime. And the article is talking about the impact of wrongful convictions because they talk about how in 2019 – it was reported that 362 people in the United States previously convicted of serious crimes have been exonerated since the founding of some of these projects that exonerate people because of, you know, DNA. And in this case, I think with Brother Ali Shabazz, that's what it is, because the Innocence Project, they're trying to get his DNA, but the state of Georgia won't even turn it over. This is what the problem is in this case. And, you know, people are saying he's innocent. And it's interesting that you brought up what you brought about how failure to take plea bargains sometimes will result in very harsh sentencing, because in this case it's cited that a 10-year deal was offered to this young man and he, you know, refused to take it because he says he was innocent. This was a case where, he was actually charged with, I think it was a rape case, but nothing. There was no proof or correct facts and even proper evidence to charge him with the sexual assault. And like they say, he's just been locked in a dark cave. During the trial, he was asked to take a DNA test to prove that he didn't commit the crime. And the DNA test came back false, and it turned out to be inconclusive, meaning that his DNA did not match the crime scene evidence. And so this sounds like something that, you know, would really give him an opportunity, I guess, Brother Jimmy, for exoneration. But, you know, as many, he's still incarcerated because, again, they say that 70% of those who are exonerated for wrongful conviction are Black. So it's very much a troubling situation with our people. During the pandemic, we see new risks arising with this over logging, and you know that was something that I really wanted to talk to you about, because as you said, it's just really on the top of your day-to-day problem. You all are down there working 24/7 almost. So yeah, and so let me just go ahead in closing. I just want to ask you, what do you think that people need to know and look for when they're hiring a lawyer, those who do have the ability to hire a lawyer? What do you think are some of the top factors they should look at, Brother Jimmy?
You know, I would say look at their track record. Look at, you know, like I tell people all the time, you know, they call me and say, hey, I've heard you're a great lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. I said, you can Google and see my wins and losses. A lot of my cases have been public. You can call the or look up from the Bar Association, see if they've had any type of infractions for lack of preparation for trial, or see if they've tried cases or. But the best indication of what a lawyer is what other lawyers think of them in that particular area, because lawyers are pretty honest. If a lawyer's crappy, another lawyer will say, hey, that's not the direction I go, or vice versa. They're a great attorney. So I would look at what is public for you to look at, their cases, their trials. They may, you know, have made the news. They may have made at least have a track record of it. Look at their disciplinary, and then look at how their peers gauge them. And then look at the recommendation from other people that have used them. How much work did they do? How, you know, were they good? Did they, you know, push you into a compromising deal, or did they fight like hell for you? I recently lost a case, and I say I lost it, not necessarily because it was a loss for my client. They offered my client 16 years. I ended up getting him 9. But I feel like I lost the case because I should have got a not guilty on it. But the work that I put into it had Black prosecutors who watched my closing crying and saying,
wow,
they shouldn't have brought this case to trial. And I don't give a damn what they say. I hope you win. These are Black prosecutors saying that, because
yes,
it was a case that was brought up that they never brought up against a white person. A self-defense case that they said his behavior in self-defense was reckless. And the reality of it is you will start to see that. I mean, the judge's case coordinator called me and just asked me how I was doing after that. And basically said, you gave it everything you got, and she's never heard a more beautiful closing in her life. She sits by the judge every day. And
wow,
so
beautiful.
What kind of passion the lawyer has for defending individuals, especially like me, that look like me, that have gotten the wrong end of the stick or have made a mistake in life. So look at those things when you decide to hire a lawyer. And then look at those who also give back and support your community.
Yes, that is so beautiful. beautiful, because as you know, as you're saying, I did find that case from what the ACLU filed Maine, and the title says that it provides ineffective defense counsel for people charged with crimes. So this is an example of how lawyers who work on behalf of impoverished criminal defendants sometimes are not giving them the best defense. And in this case, they're saying that the state officials aren't even creating a great defense system. Seems like that's going to happen. These are some of the complaints that we're seeing down in your state and other states where, you know, these big caseloads definitely can't give you the right to actually prepare for trials, investigate, talk to your clients, you know, challenge the forensic evidence and different things that need to happen. But this case out of Maine went on to say that some of the lawyers that they have contracted with have very serious disciplinary records. They've been suspended, disbarred. They even say in this article that some of these attorneys have criminal convictions, and that they really are underqualified to defend people, you know, who are facing serious charges. So, and this is an article out of the, I think it's the Capital Justice Center in by Samantha Hogan. It's a March 15, 2020 article. So, you know, again, it's a March 1st, 2022 article. So, you know, again, we have to, like Brother Jimmy said, you know, check it out. Talk to somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody before you sign on the dotted line. Lawyers oftentimes are a referral situation. Wouldn't you say, Brother Jimmy, is very, very often that someone who calls me is someone who knows somebody that I've done work for before, and then they refer. And that's a really great way to get at least get somebody who you can possibly have some trust and a relationship with. And I think that's so very important. So, Brother Jimmy, we have definitely kept you on the line. I really appreciate you sharing what you're seeing down on the ground level down in Arkansas, because I'm sure what's going on in Arkansas is probably similar to some other states. And it's so important for you to kind of let us know what's going on with some of the smaller jurisdictions where the people may not have the voices. You know, the Final Call did an interesting article on Mississippi's justice, and they talked about the extreme sentencing and keeping black people in jail for life, you know, in Mississippi, where they talked about how black men are 13% of the state's population, but make up 75% of the people serving 20 or more years in these prisons. And so, you know, it's just some real need to shine the light, and that's what I think you did. So can you go ahead and give us a way to contact you? Anyone who's looking for a lawyer may in the state of Arkansas or just might want to reach out to you, can you please give us a way of contacting you?
Okay. I am on Instagram, and on Instagram I am, if I can find it, it is J.C.ATTY, so it's just JC Attorney. I am also on Facebook as Jimmy Morris, or Jimmy C. Morris, and you can always reach me by calling my office at 501-413-7575. Again, 501-413-7575.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you again so much, Brother Jimmy, for coming on and sharing this enlightening conversation and your insight and knowledge. We really do appreciate it. And
anytime.
I can't thank you enough. Yes, sir. So, all right. Well, thank you all for listening to Time for Justice. I would like to say to hear previous shows, you can go to the Elevated Places. You can, that's MinisterAva.com as well, and you can go to our archives at the Elevated Places, as well as please listen on Thursdays to the Ask Dr. Ava show. That, of course, comes on at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. And, of course, you can listen to Sister Minister Ava's archives as well with her popular and long-running show. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team. I would like to thank Samaya Muhammad, who helps produce this show. I would like to thank Sister Donna, Brother Terrence, Sister Rona, and, of course, I would like to thank Sister Minister Ava Muhammad for all her generous work and help and giving us the opportunity to have this show, A Time for Justice. So please, thank you once again for listening. And I would like to say again, Ramadan Kareem, as we're ending, we started the show with Ramadan Mubarak, and so I would like to end by wishing you all a very successful Ramadan, and may Allah continue to bless us all. So again, thank you once again for listening, and tune in next week for more informative discussions. Assalamu alaikum.